The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Microsun Lamps.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program today Senator Sherrod Brown. Hello, Senator.
Ms. McCunis, glad to be with you, and thanks for the amazing number and depth of interviews that you've done for decades now. So thank you for that.
Well, you're very welcome. You have a new book out. It's called Desk 88, Eight Progressive Senators Who Changed America. What brought you to this? What made you decide to write this?
Well, my first month in the Senate, much of the Senate is at the beginning is done by seniority. So you choose your desk, you choose your office by seniority, your committee assignments mostly by seniority, and or you sit on the floor the same way. And there were 10 desks left for the freshmen, and we sort of scurried around and, you know, decided where we were going to sit. And there are no bad seats. It's not like sitting behind a post at the old Crosley Field in Cincinnati or so. I'd heard from a senior senator that senators, sort of like middle school, carve their names in their desk drawers. So I began to pull out four or five desk drawers of the unoccupied desks. And it said McGovern, South Dakota, Hugo Black, Alabama, Herbert Lehman of New York, Al Gore of Tennessee, and then it just said Kennedy. So I went over. Ted Kennedy sat four or five seats away, and I said, Ted, come here a second, would you? And he walked over. And I said, which brother's desk is this? And he looked at it, and he said, well, it's got to be Bobby's because I have Jack's. So I started thinking about the senators who had sat at this desk, and I wrote the book really because I was looking at these senators. I just thought about sort of the history of what I knew about a number of them. I didn't know all of them by a long shot. And I thought that, to me, it just reminded me that the power of government can be used to make people's lives better. So I chose these eight senators who had a very positive impact on our country, from collective bargaining in the 40-hour week to Social Security to minimum wage to Medicare to civil rights and all the things these eight senators had fought for and accomplished over the years.
In the book, you cite three fairly short time periods in which progressive things took place as far as legislation, and I would love to just go over these three periods and
sure.
Explain what you mean by them and what happened.
Sure. There are Emerson once, Ralph Waldo Emerson said, there's a fight, history's a battle between progressives and conservatives. He used different words, but fundamentally that conservatives want to hold on to their wealth and power and privilege. Today they would be, you know, the oil industry and the gun lobby and Wall Street and the drug companies, and progressives want to move the country forward. And progressives don't win very often in these fights because the conservators, the word Emerson used, the conservatives have everything from lobbyists to more money to more power to CEOs to now Fox TV, conservative talk radio. Progressives don't. So conservatives more often win, but when progressives win, we win really big and we have a long-term impact on the country. And that's what I talked about in these three progressive eras. The first one was during the presidency of Wilson. And while Wilson himself was very mixed, I mean, he was pretty good on worker issues, but he was clearly a racist and did some pretty awful things. Women got the vote during that period. Workers' compensation started. Direct election of senators so that special interests in the legislatures didn't dictate who would be in the Senate. The Federal Reserve was created, which at that time was considered a progressive move. Then the next progressive era was the 30s, during Roosevelt, of course. And think of what was done then, collective bargaining, 40-hour work week, Social Security. And then the 60s with LBJ was maybe the biggest progressive, if not the longest, maybe the deepest. And that was everything from Pell Grants to civil rights to voting rights to Medicare, Medicaid, Equal Opportunity Act, Head Start, Wilderness Act, Higher Ed Act, immigration reform, all these things. And in these progressive eras tend to be short, because sometimes progressives move quickly And you often don't see the advantage of you didn't. Social Security didn't come into effect until a few years after. Nobody got a check until after it had been in effect for some time and the government was taking taxes out of their paychecks. And Medicare wasn't set up immediately. And so the reaction against them is fierce from interest groups. I would add one other thing, though, Vic, to that, and that is that these eight senators, they were all white men, of course, because it was the Senate of yesteryear. I would predict that the eight senators that sit at this desk after me, there will be women, there will be people of color, and I would suggest also that they would be a deeper and more frequent progressive eras as the Senate begins to look more like America.
In case you're just tuning in, it's a Book Nook. My guest is our Senator, Sherrod Brown. And his new book is Desk 88, Eight Progressive Senators Who Changed America. Can we talk about some of these individuals?
Of course.
Hugo Black, I had been familiar with him as a Supreme Court justice. I had no idea of his background and the fact that he started off at joining the Ku Klux Klan.
Yeah, Black, there were three senators in this book that I would say had the longest journey. Where they started was not something that they were later particularly proud of, and where they ended up, they would have been labeled by many, if you share this view, as progressive heroes. Black, as you suggested, 1926 elected to the Senate, had joined from Alabama, had joined the Ku Klux Klan. He would claim that half of the voters in Alabama were members or sympathizers of the Klan, knowing no black people or count on the fingers of one or two hands, black people that actually could vote in Alabama in those days. He said he chose the Klan because he said I would go anywhere where I could get votes. Not a particularly admirable part of Hugo Black, putting it mildly. He evolved, but he still cast racist votes in the Senate. He opposed the anti-lynching bill. But by the 30s in his second term, he became Roosevelt's favorite Southern senator because he fought so much for worker rights. And it goes full circle when he went to the court 30 years after he went to the court 10 years after he was elected to the Senate. 20 years later, he was a key player in the unanimous decision, Brown v. Board of Education, which was the first time the court really ruled on integration and segregation and integration. And as a result of Brown v. Board of Education, the next year, Hugo Black was burned in effigy at his law school he had attended in Tuscaloosa. So he went from a Klansman to someone that segregationists just despised 30 years later.
That is an amazing journey. I had never heard of Glenn Taylor, the singing cowboy from Kuskia. I did not realize who he was and where he came from. He's another intriguing progressive senator.
Yeah, he was the most interesting to me because, like you, I didn't know who he was when I started. And I've asked since I started writing. I started writing this book 10 years ago, and I've read probably 100. The books were in the bibliography. I've read entirely 140 or 50 books and other parts of another 20 or so, and interviewed about 100 people. And almost nobody, I just was asking people as I was writing over 10 years, do you know who Glenn Taylor was? And my brother did because he knows all this stuff. But like almost maybe five people out of 200 I asked. I mean, he was just unknown to history. He came from Idaho. He and his wife had a singing group, Glenn and Dora Taylor, called the Glenn Dora Singers. They had a son named A-Rod, the spelling backwards of Dora, the same as the baseball player. I reached his son in California. He's a retired dentist. I reached him 10 years ago and spoke to him. And here's the story he told me. Now, Glenn Taylor ran for office seven times. He won once. He was elected in 1944. He immediately took on the issue of he went after the segregationists in the Senate, keeping one of them, the worst of all, Governor Senator Bilbo of Mississippi, keeping him from being seated in the Senate in 1947. But then in 1948, he was Henry Wallace's, the Progressive Party tickets, the Progressive Party's nominee. He was his running mate. And Wallace started off with a lot of votes, high percentage in polls, a pretty high percentage, ended up with very few votes. But Taylor, and this is his son telling me, A-Rod, Taylor went to Birmingham to campaign for the ticket. and spoke at an integrated audience in Alabama and went in a door that white people weren't supposed to enter. And he was arrested, and he spent the night in Bull Connor's Birmingham jail. And his son was talking about just that how courageous his dad was, and that his dad really feared for his life when Bull Connor's thugs picked him up and drove him around Birmingham before depositing him in the jail. And if you remember, 15 years later, Bull Connor was the awful sheriff in Birmingham in the early mid-60s that turned the fire hoses on the demonstrators and captured the attention of voters in the North who rose up and said, we've got to deal with this and we've got to pass civil rights. And so he, in an upside-down way, Bull Connor helped us get to a civil rights bill.
Mm-hmm. And this Bilbo character, whew, I had never heard of him. What a scary guy.
Yeah, he was a governor then Senator Mississippi, and it was just he wasn't just a racist. The kinds of things he was willing to publicly say. And he was running in a state where blacks weren't voting, of course, and he thought playing to people's lowest possible common denominator, to the lowest, their lowest basest views would elect him, and it did. But in 1947, because Taylor, one of the most dramatic moments really in the book, Taylor rose on the Senate floor. And in those days, there were a number of Republicans, including Senator Taft, who were somewhat supportive of civil rights. There were Northern Democrats and some Northern Republicans. And they stopped him from being seated. Is a result of Glenn Taylor's courage, this senator who had been in office exactly 2 years at that point.
Amazing. Just one of the stories in Desk 88, Eight Progressive Senators Who Changed America. I've been joined by our senator, Sherrod Brown, on the telephone. Are you in Cleveland, sir?
I'm home in Cleveland today, yep. So, and happy Veterans Day. I guess you're going to run this later, but I'm calling you from Cleveland on Veterans Day.
Thank you. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, Building a More Informed Community with Independent News and Storytelling. And Senator Brown is out publicizing his new book. He's taken a little bit of time out of his hectic schedule to do some events in our region. And if you want to come and see him, you have a couple of opportunities. Tomorrow, he will be in Columbus, a special event put on by the Thurber House for the publication of Desk 88. And the Thurber House isn't quite big enough for the crowd that they're expecting, so they are having this at the Meese Auditorium of Capital University. That's One College and Main in Bexley, Ohio. And that's being promoted by the Thurber House. That is tomorrow night, Sunday, November 17th, from 7 o'clock until 8:30. You can come out and hear Senator Sherrod Brown. I'll continue my interview with the senator right after this. The Book Nook continues on WYSO with my special guest, Senator Sherrod Brown. And if you're unable to come out and see the senator tomorrow in Columbus, actually in Bexley, at the event put on by the Thurber House, Capital University Meese Auditorium, 7 o'clock tomorrow night, that's at One College in Maine. You have one other opportunity when he's coming through our region to talk about the book, and that will be on Friday, November 22nd. Senator Brown will be at Joseph Beth Bookstore. That's in Cincinnati, 2692 Madison Road. That's Friday, November 22nd at 7 o'clock. Al Gore Sr., leading from the South. He's another portrait. This is Al Gore Jr.'s father. And another guy, he was a Southerner, and one of the first things that he was asked to do when he joined the Senate, Strom Thurmond approached him and made a demand, didn't he?
Yeah, Al Gore, when I said three senators had a long journey from their early career into their last part of their career, I talked about Hugo Black. Gore is the second. Bobby Kennedy be the third, and we can talk about that if you want. Mm-hmm. Gore started off. Gore showed a lot of courage. He was the only one of only three Southern senators who refused to sign the Communist, the Southern Manifesto. Uh-huh. And it was put together by Strom Thurmond and Richard Russell and the most virulent segregationists. And it was in protest to Brown v. Board of Education, which we had talked about earlier, as you remember, Vic. And so he refused to sign it. Thurmond tried to embarrass him, and Gore just said hell no, literally said hell no on the Senate floor to him in a loud voice. But Gore was uneven. Gore voted in 1964 against the Civil Rights Act, even though his 16-year-old son, the future vice president, and his 26-year-old daughter implored him to please vote for it. The next year, he voted for voting rights in 65, and then he went on, and he lost his seat in large part because Nixon went after him with his new Southern strategy in 1970. He lost his seat because of the courage he showed against the Vietnam War, the only Tennessee politician that was publicly against it, and because he stood up on race issues against two nominees that Nixon had tried to put on the Supreme Court, Carswell and Haynesworth. So Gore had a journey. His was Black's was sort of straight line more. Gore's was more uneven. But Gore, by 1970, maybe because he had already been in the Senate 18 years, maybe by then he had put his presidential ambitions aside. I'm not clear on that, but Gore was willing to stand up for what he believed in and willing to lose his seat, and that's what happened.
Now we're getting up to the period where I actually remember some of these people. They're actually from my lifetime, and one of them, I didn't know much about him. William Proxmire.
Yeah, Proxmire was Proxmire was the most unusual and eccentric of the eight. Elected, he ran three times for governor and for governor, and for 2-year terms in 52, 4, and 6. And after every election, he had cards printed up. If he won and if he lost, and the next morning he went to plant gates and handed out his cards and after each loss, and he said, I lost last night, but I'm not giving up, and thank you for your support. Thank you for voting for me, and that he handed out at plant gates. Then in 57, he won a special election through a series of fortuitous circumstances to replace Joe McCarthy, the senator who was on the anti-communist crusade and ruined a lot of lives in the process, who died in office. He had a pretty tragic alcoholism, really killed him early. And Proxmire, then he won election after election. He somehow won elections overwhelmingly in spending almost no money. The only money he would spend was to buy stamps, to send checks back, to put on envelopes to send checks back to people that want to contribute. He essentially spent no money in the campaign. And the reason, it was a different day, and there were fewer interest groups that came in and, you know, the oil industry and the Koch brothers trying to take people out that way. But what he did was he would always go home. He never went anywhere else except back to Wisconsin, shaking hands all the time. He would stand outside Milwaukee County Stadium, and if you went to a Brewers or a Braves game in those days, people would walk out and they'd run into Senator Proxmire saying, "How are you? I'm Bill Proxmire," and he'd do that everywhere, even on Easter Sunday. Herb Kohl, his Jewish successor in that seat, Herb Kohl told me that when Proxmire was in the Senate, Herb was out on Easter Sunday having dinner, I believe, or lunch in Racine, Wisconsin, I think, if I remember right. And Proxmire walked in and shook hands table to table. I'm Bill Proxmire. And he would later say that he didn't really have the kind of life he maybe should have had because he was so focused on this job and keeping this job. But he was a good senator, and he did some really good consumer things on banking legislation. He was chairman of the banking committee, the committee, if the Democrats win the Senate in 2020, I will be chairman of. So I liked a lot of the things he did that way.
Hard on a marriage living like that.
Yeah, well, he wasn't successful a couple of times, and who knows ever why that happens. But he later said some things that a bit wistfully about his service that way. It's a good lesson for all of us in any jobs.
In case you've just joined us, my guest is our Senator Sherrod Brown, and we're talking about his new book, Desk 88, Eight Progressive Senators Who Changed America. You've mentioned Robert Kennedy, and I really got emotionally overwhelmed by this chapter. This is so powerful. I had forgotten about his vision. And what an amazing man. And he went through a transformation, as you say.
He went through a big transformation. I mean, he started off, his dad probably got him the job working for Joe McCarthy on that committee that went after and ruined people's lives. And Bobby was a young lawyer and ambitious and did that. Then when he was chosen attorney general by his brother in 1961, he tapped Dr. Martin Luther King's telephones. So he didn't have necessarily a proud first years of his career. That's not unusual for Kennedys. Kennedys, the three Kennedy brothers that were in elective office, typically were much better in the second part of their careers than the first. Jack wasn't known as a particularly good senator. Ted's first 20 years in the Senate was, he was consumed by presidential ambition. I would argue the last 20 years of Ted Kennedy's career in the Senate, when I got to know him, I got to know him in the latter part of that. He was probably, in my mind, the best senator in American history. So Bobby's death of his brother, the assassination of the president, clearly changed him, of course. There's a wonderful quote Lincoln once said that his staff wanted him to stay in the White House and win the war and free the slaves and preserve the Union. And Lincoln said, no, I have to get my public opinion bath and every week or every day. And Bobby Kennedy did that better. Perhaps it had more impact than any elected official I know, where he saw things up close. He saw poverty, he saw injustice, and it really did affect him. And he was a very empathetic. He had a great deal of empathy and compassion that developed over time in the last. So the Kennedy we all know is the Kennedy from 1966, 67, in the presidential race in 68. That's the evolved Kennedy that was a progressive hero to so many people.
And he was willing to do something that is so rare today. He was willing to say, I was wrong.
Yeah, he was, and that's right. And he, and most human beings aren't willing to do that, and politicians are even less willing overall. So he was a remarkable guy, and he was a loner. And one of the things about this book that's been really fun is after it was published just a week ago, I got a letter from a guy I know last night who read the book as soon as he got it, and I did a speech at the City Club a few days ago in Cleveland about it, and he read it, and he knew Bobby Kennedy. He didn't know him well, but so I'm getting insights. I also got a text last night from Fred Harris, who's mentioned in the book. Harris was a 33-year-old freshman senator and sat next to Robert Kennedy in their time in the Senate in 1965. So people are reading it if they're in their 60s, 70s, and 80s, they had some connection with Proxmire or Kennedy or McGovern. McGovern is the only one of the eight whom I actually knew and actually talked to. I saw Proxmire once from a distance. I didn't even lay eyes on any of the other six. But I had some really good discussions with McGovern about his time in the Senate and as presidential candidate and his view of the world. And one of the things McGovern said was that if you really do read history and work to understand it, you have to be a progressive. You can't understand. If you understand history, that will be your political philosophy. I know that not every listener in Oakwood or Huber Heights necessarily agrees with that. But that's the way McGovern saw it, and that's the way really I saw it. And as I said, I wrote this book because I really do believe that government can be a positive. The power of government can be used to help people's lives, and that's what these progressives did, all eight of them.
When you were at the City Club in Cleveland, I understand you did a Q&A with your partner in life, Connie Schultz. Did you then take questions from the audience? Did you pull a Bobby Kennedy?
Oh, I always do. I always take questions from the audience. Yeah, that's an interesting story that Vic obviously has read this because his questions are so good. Bobby Kennedy, the day that most of us have seen, you can obviously see it on YouTube, when Kennedy, after King was shot Kennedy was in an Indiana airport campaigning in Indiana in the presidential race. He heard before he took off in a plane that King was shot. When he landed, King had died, and he then went to a speech in the African American part of Indianapolis, stood on the back of a flatbed truck. King had died maybe an hour earlier. And nobody in the audience knew it because there was no social media, no cell phones, all that. So he announced that, and it's an amazing just speech off, obviously not a prepared speech. The next day, he canceled all his events, save one, and the one he didn't cancel was his speech to the Cleveland City Club, which then still, but then especially, was known as one of the most important places to give an important speech, a major policy address. And he changed his speech. He spoke mostly about gun violence. And the City Club was started in, I believe, 1915, something like that. And the City Club had a rule that no one, no exceptions, could speak there without taking questions. And Kennedy, and there have been presidents, everybody that goes to City Club, I've been there a number of times, they have political figures in all the time, and authors and others, everyone's taking questions. Kennedy spoke, he began to cry at the end of his speech. He walked off the stage, and Alan Davies, who ran the City Club in those days, and I met Alan Davies later, told me that he just didn't have the guts to go up to Kennedy and say, get back up there and answer questions. So that's the only time in City Club history, the day after Dr. King's assassination, that Bobby Kennedy didn't take questions.
You're listening to The Book Nook. My guest is our U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown, who joins us on the telephone in Cleveland, and his new book is Desk 88, Eight Progressive Senators Who Changed America. Now we get to my favorite. You just mentioned him, George McGovern. What a wonderful man, and I so much appreciated him. We had him on the show a couple times. He wrote a biography of Abraham Lincoln. He also wrote a book about what it meant to him to be a Democrat. What an amazing guy.
Yeah, and kind. He was mostly kind, and that was he started off, he was a Democrat in about the most Republican place on earth, South Dakota, and he figured out how to win. He had losses, certainly his 72 presidential race, but he was always committed. My favorite story about him is, I had dinner with him three or four times and had probably got to spend an hour or more with him half dozen times. And one of his major goals in the world was to combat hunger. And he met John the 23rd, the Pope, in the 60s. And he said, the Pope greeted him and he said, when you meet your maker, you can tell him that you fed the hungry. And that would be, I can't imagine that any of us could ever hear that from Pope John the 23rd and not make that one of the great moments of someone's life. And McGovern certainly felt that way.
And I think that was the thing that was the most important to him, that he talked about. The thing that made him feel the best was that he had fed the hungry.
That's right. And one of the things I learned from studying history like this, and I've always loved history like you do, but I never went a deep dive like this and did this kind of research, was that you really learn what, if you're an elected official or a journalist, do what any of us does. Sometimes you understand the most important things you do that nobody learns about or nobody knows about or nobody credits you with. And I told a story at the end of that chapter where McGovern, I was presiding over the Senate. It's something freshmen do. Freshmen in the majority party is the way it works. And McGovern walked in the back of the Senate, and I looked up, saw him there, and I asked, there are four or five pages that sit on the steps by the presiding officer in the Senate, high school kids, and I said, you know who that is?
Mm-hmm.
And by sight, and they said no. And I said, his name's George McGovern. He was senator from South Dakota. They still didn't know. And I understood that because history, as Marcus Aurelius says, is fleeting. History is fleeting. People's knowledge is fleeting. Our place on earth is short. But at the end of the chapter, I said, they may not have known who George McGovern was, but nor do the hungry, the people he fed through the McGovern Dole, his friend Bob Dole, a conservative Republican with a liberal Democrat, they started something called McGovern Dole so that children in the developing world get at least one hot meal a day. And so I said at the end of the chapter, these people don't know who George McGovern is, but millions of children are getting one hot meal a day. And what better legacy is there than that?
I agree. Senator, I'm curious, what's your 2020 vision? How do the Democrats win in Ohio in 2020?
Well, Democrats win in Ohio by talking and understanding the dignity of work, and that's honoring and respecting all work. Dr. King said, "No work is no job is menial if it pays adequate wages." And Democrats need to campaign through the eyes of workers and need to plan an agenda and govern through the eyes of workers. And you know, that's not just white male union workers. It's people that work in Miami Valley Hospital. It's people that sell insurance in Springfield. It's people that work construction in Xenia. It's people that are data entry operators at a bank in Dayton. It's people that that prepare food at Right Pad. It's people that, because all work has dignity, whether you punch a clock or swipe a badge or work for tips or raising children. And Trump, I would make the Democrats need to talk about the dignity of work and contrast that with President Trump's betrayal of workers. The president's refused to raise the minimum wage, hasn't been raised in over a decade. He's undermined the overtime rule, which means 40 or 50,000 Ohioans that work an additional 10 hours a week will not get paid overtime. He's sided with the big banks and the drug companies and the oil industry against farmers and workers over and over again. And if Democrats make that case that we're the party of work and workers and the president has undermined all of that, Democrats win Ohio.
And for those of us who are still fantasizing that you will fling your fedora into the circle.
Yeah, I made that decision, and I just don't like you. You know, to run for president, you've got to really, really, really want to be president. It's too difficult a process and painful a process, and your family sacrifices too much. And unless your ambition is you really want to be president, you just simply can't do it. And I've never planned in my life to run for president. I love that I pinch myself that I get to be a senator from a state as big and great and important as Ohio. And it was not in the cards for me to go out and spend 15, 16, 18, 20 months with, you know, running for president. Pretty simple. There's a story I love to tell. A senator from Vermont 60, 70 years ago said, "The only cure for the presidential virus in the U.S. Senate is embalming fluid." And I just don't want to be that guy. I drift.
Well, Senator, it's really been a pleasure talking to you about your
Mine
book.
Mine too. Thank you. What a great interview. Thanks, Vic.
Thank you.
Good luck.
My special guest today on the program has been Senator Sherrod Brown, who joined us on the telephone at his residence in Cleveland. And he will be in our area tomorrow for an event to mark the publication of his book, Desk 88, a book that was 10 years in the making. And that event is being put on by the Thurber House in Columbus, and it's being held at the Capital University Meese Auditorium at One College in Maine in Bexley, and that is at 7 o'clock tomorrow night until 8:30. You can come out and hear the senator speak and maybe even pick up a signed copy of his book. I assume they'll be doing that. And if you're not able to attend that event in Columbus area tomorrow, he has one other event in our region. You can put this on your calendar. Friday, November 22nd at 7 p.m., he'll be at the Joseph Beth Bookstore in Cincinnati, 2692 Madison Road. 7 p.m. Friday, November 22nd is your other opportunity to see the senator in our region talking about this very informative bit of history, Desk 88, and all the progressive senators who have occupied that desk at the Capitol prior to the election of Sherrod Brown. And speaking of senators who have occupied that particular seat, the last one we talked about on the program this morning was Senator George McGovern. He ran for president in 1972 against the incumbent, Richard Nixon. Nixon won by a landslide. And Senator McGovern went back to Desk 88 in the Senate. We all know how the Nixon presidency ended. Back in those days, back when he ran for president in 1972, I wasn't old enough to vote for George McGovern, but I liked the man. I supported him. I felt good about him. And one thing that I really liked about him was, after being deeply involved in the quagmire of the Vietnam War, in 1968, after the incumbent Lyndon Baines Johnson decided not to run for re-election, this gave an opportunity to Richard Nixon to win the presidency. And one of his campaign promises in 1968 was that he was going to end the Vietnam War. Well, it didn't happen during that first term, and sentiment against the war expanded greatly between 1968 and 1972. I was one of those young people who didn't really see a good reason for us to be there, and I was concerned because as I got a little bit older, if the war continued, I would get drafted and I would be sent there. So I was pretty excited about George McGovern's stand on the Vietnam War. He wanted us to get out of there. He was very outspoken about it. That was part of his platform. So when he announced that he was running for president, I heard about it, and I heard he was going to come to Des Moines, my hometown, to be interviewed by the editorial board at the Des Moines Register and Tribune. My friend Steve and I went downtown. It was a snowy night, kind of like the nights we've had here recently, and we stood outside the building at the Des Moines Register and Tribune and waited and hoped that Senator McGovern would come out that door. Sure enough, he did. He walked out, and we ran over to him very excited and talked to him for a few moments. There were only about a half dozen people waiting for him, and maybe a half dozen photographers following him. The cameras flashed, and that was it. The next week, I opened up Newsweek magazine, and here was a photo of George McGovern with the caption, "McGovern seeks grassroots support in Iowa." And standing right next to him was my friend Steve, and standing right on the other side of him, just the three of us, was me. With George McGovern, one of my favorite moments. And I talked to George McGovern about that during one of the interviews I did with the late senator. Stay tuned. A special Book Nook bonus coming your way with the late Senator George McGovern. You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO and following my interview with our current Senator Sherrod Brown. I thought it would be fun to look back at one of the interviews I did with Senator George McGovern, one of the other occupants of Desk 88. And this excerpt is from my final interview with George, recorded 8 years ago in November 2011. The debate that we seem to be having right now is over the very purpose of government. In your book, you state that we're at a crossroads as far as allocating financial resources. You mentioned the good things that the government has done over the years, FDR's programs. You mentioned the rural electric programs, which, had they been in effect earlier, might have illuminated a young George McGovern absconding with a watermelon.
Well, I confess, I got one dark chapter in my life. When I was about 12 to 15, I would go into watermelon fields that went on for hundreds of acres. And my friends and I would swipe a watermelon and then take it somewhere and eat it. I don't think we broke up any of the watermelon groves, but it still wasn't our property. So is George McGovern always right? No, I stole watermelons as a teenager. One of my friends, when he saw the back door of a farmhouse open, the farmer yelled out at us, he took off running for top speed with a big watermelon in his arms, and he didn't see a barbed wire fence coming. Oh. He hit that fence at full speed. If a guy can run 60 miles an hour, that's what he was doing. That watermelon exploded like a bomb. It drenched him in watermelon juice and two or three of the rest of us. but it made us think seriously about our life of crime.
You make the point in that chapter, The Purpose of Government, that the grand old party, the Republicans, celebrate the individual, but they need to also remember community and generosity. And speaking of generosity, the next chapter is food and hunger. And you have an account of a conversation that you had with John F. Kennedy during the 1960 campaign. He was coming to the Corn Palace in your hometown, and you gave him some advice.
Well, he had spoken before that day at the National Corn Picking Contest outside of Sioux Falls, and he laid an egg. It was raining, it was windy, it was cold. Somebody had written him an agricultural speech, which he didn't understand too well. After all, he was a Boston guy and a New York guy, and he wasn't familiar with South Dakota, Montana, Nebraska, Kansas, and so on. So he said, George, I've got to speak now in your hometown, Mitchell, South Dakota, the Corn Palace. I understand there are 5,000 or 6,000 people jammed into that corn. What should I do now? I said, Jack, if I were you, I'd throw away that speech. It's no good anyway. And I would go out there without a note and say, I think the farmers of South Dakota and North Dakota and Iowa and Wisconsin and Ohio can do more good in the world than any other instrument we have if we remember that food is power, food is strength, food is hope in a hungry, torn, bleeding world. And we're going to use our agricultural abundance to feed hungry people in India, in Pakistan, in Japan, which was still suffering from World War II, in China, which was still not on the advanced stage they are today. And he got up and made that speech, and he said, if I'm elected, I'm going to name a Food for Peace director to come to the White House and direct a maximum effort to use our farm surpluses to feed hungry people abroad. And incidentally, he gave me that job.
He called you, didn't he, after he got elected?
He got elected by a half of a percentage point. I got defeated in South Dakota by about the same margin. He called up and said, well, George, I'm sorry I cost you that election in South Dakota. I said, Mr. President, you didn't cost me that election. It was the voters that decided they wanted somebody else in the United States Senate. No, he said, Bobby told me what was going on out there, and please come and see me before you make any plans. Well, yeah, he lifted me from the depths of despair to almost delirious hope, and that's when I got the job as Food for Peace director. I traveled the world feeding hungry people. I think it's fair to say that in a long career, I've fed more hungry people than any other person in the history of the world. Hmm. That's the conclusion of an Oxford historian who recently completed a book on historical feeding efforts.
Wow. My guest is George McGovern. His book is What It Means to Be a Democrat. For the last 30 years or so, we've heard rumblings from the Republican Party about shrinking government, about getting rid of whole departments of the government. In this book, you say, well, the Department of Homeland Security could go, but just last night there was a Republican debate where one of the candidates couldn't remember all the departments he wanted to get rid of, but one of the ones that he mentioned was the Department of Education. And you have a wonderful quote from your old friend Gene McCarthy in this section of the book where you say, quote, the Republicans have a lot of good Republicans. They just never run any of them for office.
Well, they used to run good ones for office. I mentioned George Norris, the senator from Nebraska, La Follette from Wisconsin, Peter Norbeck from South Dakota, Cummins from Iowa. We've had a lot of good Republicans in the Congress and in the White House. And we need two good parties. We really do. We need the competition of a conservative party on one hand and a liberal party on the other. Now, one thing that does disturb me about some of these people who have announced they're running for the Republican presidential nomination is that they seem to hate the United States government. If you listen to them, and it's true also with some of the television people, especially on Fox TV, they seem to hate the United States government. I love the government of the United States. I have no hesitance in saying it's the best in the world. Does it make mistakes? Of course. The government is composed of human beings, but they do a lot of good things. I feel that the taxes I pay to the federal government bring me greater benefits than any other investment I make. And I think a lot of Americans feel that way. So we've got to stop talking about the federal government as though it's a monster sitting there in Washington ready to jump on us. It's not. Just find me a government around the world that's any better, and I'll pay your way to an Ohio State football game.
Okay.
So anyway, this is the way I feel about it. I admire the people that work for the United States government. Not always. Some of them are a little short on what I'd like to see. Mm-hmm. But basically, you travel the world as I have, and you'll come back glad that you live in the United States of America. What bothers me is this constant assailing of the federal government. Look at all the positive things the government does. We've got the most beautiful national parks, national forests in the world. We've got the Tennessee Valley Authority that has brought low-cost electricity to a dozen states in the South. We have Social Security, a wonderful program. Medicare, the only thing about Medicare, I would extend it to everybody. I've been getting it since I turned 65, and it's wonderful. It just means that the federal government pays your medical bills. And those medical bills are going up all the time as we get older, so I think we ought to extend that to every American. On education, it would cost a lot, of course, to provide education to all of the middle-income and low-income students. But you want to know something about the GI Bill that I benefited from after World War II? It educated about 8 million GIs. Mm. The government paid every dime of our education. I went all the way through to a Ph.D. in history at Northwestern. But the government actually made money on it. And let me tell you why. All of us, after we got these fine educations, were earning more money than otherwise would be the case. So for the last 50 or 60 years, the federal government has been collecting more taxes from us 8 million that benefited that program. Uh-huh. The government's made $2 for every dollar the program costs. I think the same thing would apply today if the government picked up the tab for higher education for low-income and middle-income youngsters. The very rich can pay for higher education. The middle class and the working class can't. So let's do something about that.
That was the late Senator George McGovern, who ran for president in 1972 and was defeated by Richard M. Nixon. His final appearance in the Book Nook, he came to see us twice, or at least we talked to him on the phone twice. That was for his book, What It Means to Be a Democrat. And his previous book was a biography of Abraham Lincoln that he talked about. And before that, we had Senator Sherrod Brown, who is the current occupant of Desk 88, George McGovern's former desk at the Capitol. And Senator Brown was kind enough to give us some time, and he did mention that he does not have plans to enter the presidential race in 2020. He did mention that during the interview. You heard it here on The Book Nook on WYSO. Thanks for listening.